Hello. Welcome to the show, LE2B. I'm Tom McCaffrey. I'm here with Eric B., Eric Bronstein. Before we start, please buy my book, Born Funny, a comics chronicle through the rise of alt comedy. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, a bunch of stuff. Also, I'm having a book release show, comedy show, to kind of kick it off on March 5th. At 7:30 at Pianos downtown on right off Rivington, and Eric Bees is on the show. Mm-hmm. So, and a couple other Vanessa Jackson might be on it.
Yeah, she said she would do it. So
from SNL, yeah. Right? She writes for SNL, and then a couple other people. So check that out. Also, please donate to our Patreon because that helps us keep the show going. So anything you can. Donate on our Patreon at LE2B, and you can get bonus content there. So we would appreciate any small donation or anything. Okay. And
did you hear that?
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, also our sponsor, Silk City Hot Sauce. Go to silkcityhotsauce.com and use LE2B as your promo code, and you get a 15% discount. So check that out. Check nice. All that out.
Well, so I just... saying, yeah, no, the theme, the music, our playing music. Do you know what that was?
No, I was trying to let it play a little bit, but now
it's the theme song to The Last of Us, which is a new show on HBO. That's I don't really love zombie stuff, but I like this show. It's pretty good. I don't know. I enjoy it more than Walking Dead, but I don't know. Walking Dead was on for like 27 years, so.
Yeah, I never got into The Walking Dead. I just felt like it was just the same. Where can you really go with it? This one, I guess what kind of turned me off, I watched the first episode, was, you know, it's based on a video game, and that was already kind of one strike. I'm like, okay, that's...
Yeah, I was not familiar with the video game, so like the nerds are like, oh, this is different from the video game. I'm like, well, if you want to watch the video game, play the video game. I don't understand.
Yeah,
they're not going to make it the same. Then why would you watch it? You know.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the Pac-Man series on HBO.
They actually did it like a parody of it on Saturday Night Live because that Pedro Pascal, who's the star of the show, he's really good. He's blowing up. That guy is in everything. He's like in every movie, and they did it like their own parody of like Mario Kart, like a serious Mario Kart.
I saw that. That was funny.
But he's been, you know what movie he was also in? He was in the, apparently he's on that Mandalorian show, which I don't know, but he's
also... Nicolas Cage movie?
Yeah, which, you know, he was funny in that.
Did you see that?
Yeah, I like that movie.
I thought it was good. I didn't really know what to expect, but it was really good.
It was played to his strengths perfectly, you know?
It did. And did you read the behind the scenes where Nicolas Cage wouldn't do it for so long because he was... it's sort of like he thought I was making fun of him, and it was sort of offensive. I feel like that happens all the time. These guys, they take themselves so seriously, so they kind of like shoot themselves in the foot, where it's like that, you know, Nicolas Cage is just, for the last 20 years, hasn't he just, you have a joke about it, right? Where it's like every movie he does is just the worst movie.
Yeah.
And like, well, he just does like 30 movies a year.
Well, now he's done, because he had all that money problem. I think it was IRS things. And so then I think he started just being in every movie to pay off bills, you know, and I think that's kind of hurt him in a way, because he would just be in everything.
And then but it's like this one was an actual like well thought out.
Yeah.
Clever take on him. And it was funny. And it was just kind of making light of him. But I don't know. You're not going to do that, but you're going to do fucking
Ghost Rider Ghost 7,
Rider 8 or something. Yeah. It's just, you know, the National Treasure. What was he in? Wasn't he in National Treasure?
Was yeah. That... Yeah. That was him.
Oh yeah. National Treasure. So yeah, it's like, you know, oh, I wouldn't do it for so long. I thought it was, you know, really stupid. Like, okay, that's, and then, you know, it always ends up being the only good thing they've done. But
didn't he play himself in another movie, adaptation? Did he play himself in that movie?
No, he plays Charlie Kaufman, the writer guy who wrote it, and I think he directed it, and who wrote Being John Malkovich. I feel like that was sort of the beginning of, you know, it was like after the millennium or around the millennium where like pop culture things started shifting, like became a lot more self-aware, you know that, where it was like people were playing themselves, and it was kind of about entertainment, and it was like behind the scenes, and
Yeah, they said a lot of that might have started from the Larry Sanders Show, where, you know, we always take it for granted now where these actors play themselves, but like an exaggerated version of themselves. They said that was really kind of where that started on the Larry Sanders Show, where they would have guests on playing themselves, but they would play like douchey versions of themselves, or maybe accurate versions of themselves. Who knows?
Yeah. And actually Seinfeld early on was one of the earliest examples where they did that, the kind of the self-aware, like showing behind the scenes, like when they did the episodes of them doing the show on the show. That was like a very unique and prescient thing. Like no one had done that before. And then everything kind of became that. So it kind of makes sense. Like, of course, Larry David is like ahead of the curve with did it kind of before everyone. But yeah, so it was good. I've been watching. So Last of Us, this was a big thing I heard about it. The second or third episode got all this attention because it was more kind of like focusing on like a relationship between these two dudes.
Right. So it was Nick Offerman. And then the other guy who was the guy, I think his name was Murray in real life. But anyway, he was the guy from White Lotus in the original Armand.
Yeah, he's in everything now, too. He's in the Chippendales movie.
Oh, is he? Yeah. So they, they were just focused on their relationship. And, you know, there were some heavy sex scenes like where
kind of like the video game, right? That video game where the two dudes have sex.
So I was talking to some people who felt uncomfortable about it. I had no problem with it. I thought it was fine, you know, but they
was it graphic?
It was a couple of parts. Well, seeing like Nick's Ron Swanson, you know, Ron Swanson, because he basically plays a character that's just like Ron Swanson, you know, and he's making out with a guy. So I guess people aback. And I was telling some people, I'm like, but that's what straight actors like to do, because it's like chasing awards in a way, you know, and it's like it's almost like the more gay stuff you do, like the more awards you'll get. Like eventually, you know, Dustin Hoffman will just be blowing somebody in the movie, you know.
Is that true? Is that a recent thing, or
I think it's just people, you know, Hollywood likes those people who do those roles, those chancy roles, and
showing. It's funny if you play a role that's gay and there's some like, you know, some sort of graphic sex in it, then you get awards. But if you go all the way and just do gay porn, you're just like, get at it. You'll never work again. You're like, it's like, no, I'm actually going further. I'm actually blowing, dude. I'm really doing it. Like, yeah. Whatever. You're not good.
But you're not doing it on HBO. That's the problem. You have to do it on a prestige network. So
right. And it's like, is it harder to not be a gay guy and go and actually blow dudes and act like you like it on film, or to just pretend like you're gay and then have to do the gay sex?
I think actually doing the gay sex should get the Emmys and the Oscars. I feel like that's more work. Is it me? Also, I don't know.
No, it would attract a lot more families to watch that. It'd become more of a family show if every award was just hardcore gay sex. So,
but I think even now, we have a guest coming in a second. I think even now, like maybe the actor, like the director, will always want to probably push it and go to the actor. Hey, you want to just make out with this guy, or, you know, grab his cock? And maybe the actor is probably like, he doesn't want to seem homophobic. So like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll totally do that. You know, you want me to blow the guy, whatever, you know, because they want to seem like they're being serious about their role. So,
yeah. Yeah, totally. I guess that is a thing that's people have become a lot more comfortable. I feel like years ago, if you played a gay character, it could really hurt your career. They'd be like, you'll never work again.
Right. But, I mean, even if you see Tom Hanks in Philadelphia, which was a groundbreaking role, I don't think they ever kiss in the movie. They don't even kiss. I think there's one scene where Antonio Banderas is like kissing his hand, you know, but that's it, you know. And think how much we've changed in 40 years. And 40 years from now, that's what I'm saying. You're going to see just like fucking just anal on TV. And they'll be like, this is
Oscar buzz. There's a lot of Oscar buzz. Yeah, that is funny, man. He did a great job in that movie where he was gay and never touched the guy. I'm gay in this movie. Hey, get the hell away from me. Don't touch me. Seriously, but I am gay. Just the guy's gay. So
should we let our guest?
Yeah, let's let him
we'll keep talking though till
yeah.
Yeah. So So I think that's the future. I mean, if you really want to get the roles, you know,
he came. Yeah, he's coming at a really odd time in the conversation.
Hey,
there he is. There he is.
What's up? All right, I'm gonna introduce our guest. We're very excited to have him on. He's a comedian I've known for a while, and I just did his podcast a little while ago, Broccoli and Ice Cream. He's done like everything. He was on Letterman, Conan, Tonight Show, Comedy Central. He had a special called Small, Dork, and Handsome, and a CD called AKA. Please give it up for Mike Kaplan. Thanks for coming.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I think I did everything except for this podcast. So.
Yeah, so here you are finally.
Yeah.
Off your bucket list.
Even Letterman did this podcast, didn't he? Or that was just something I dreamt, I guess.
It's been so long, he might as well have. So how's it going? Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Do you guys, do you know Aaron? You guys have probably met in the past, right? Yeah. Okay, cool. Before you came on, we were just talking about The Last of Us. Do you know that show?
I haven't watched it, and I think I may. So I came on at a good time after you talked about it. But haven't seen it yet, but hear that everyone's talking about it. Literally everyone.
Are you into stuff like that, like zombies and like video? Are you into video games? Because you know, people might think you are because like you kind of a part of your persona is you're well dorky. I mean, you said I'm just repeating.
Hey, yeah. Why did don't try to pigeonhole me with the title of a special that I named about myself.
Right.
I mean, of course, there are many ways to be a dork today, and I feel like. I hope that everyone is one in some way. I hope everyone loves something enough to, you know, really geek out about it, to really get into it. Like, even if you're a sports dork, you know what I mean? They probably don't call themselves that, but you're sports dorks. Sports dorks.
I'm a sex dork.
Oh man, super into it. I learn everything about it. I read up all about it. I don't have time to do it, but I'm reading a lot about it.
Totally. Well, that's a good way to get into it.
But you gotta learn. When I was a kid, I grew up in the 80s and had the original Nintendo. Then I got the Super Nintendo in high school. And then when I went to college and then started being, you know, grown, I purposefully did not purchase any further video gaming systems for fear that I would be too much of a video game person, because I have a kind of maximizing, obsessive leaning personality, and like I have completest tendencies in my past and my present. And so I, to answer specifically about now, I mean, I have like a VR, like an Oculus headset, which I feel like is the closest thing, virtual reality. Like I play, there's a ping pong game in it and there's a mini golf game and I like those. And I think that technically those are probably like video games.
Does that feel like you're really there playing it? Like,
I mean, it definitely, like, it doesn't look like, it's not photorealistic. It looks like you're in, you know, an artificial world, but like you swing, you know, it feels like I'm swinging a club and it really, you know, I'm not a mini golf dork, but I like mini golf. And of the times that I've played it in real life, it feels very similar to doing it. And I'm big into ping pong, and I mean, the game like glitches every once in a while, but when it's working, like it's not exactly the same, but it's like, you know, the closest, it's of all the approximations of ping pong, it's way better than the original football game on Nintendo was compared to regular football, where you could only throw left, throw right, throw straight, or run.
Yeah. Well, when did you, so you said you stopped kind of playing video games in college, kind of consciously. Yeah. So
I just want to agree with him there, because I really did the same thing. I think it's an awful time suck. And I waste my time so much on everything. I also feel like this virtual ping pong can take some of your time, but these games like The Last of Us and stuff, these are these games where you're just playing for hours. There's a story involved. Those games kill you. And I know guys who play it for hours. I don't even know how they have jobs. Like, I don't understand when they do it.
Well, that's the, you know, the economy has really, you know, rallied around these guys because, as I understand it, you can get paid by people watching you play video games. Now, that's, you know, somehow the weird dream. But I feel like similarly, you know, I'm not, I don't mean to suggest that I'm like better than anyone who, like, I feel like I'm, I could be the worst, like, you know, time sucked video game player of all if, like, there's, there's a woman named Gretchen Rubin who's written a bunch of books. One is The Happiness Project. One is The Four Tendencies, which I really like. And she talks about different modalities of like personalities. Like some people are abstainers and some are moderators. Some people like can be like, if there's chips in the house, I'm eating them. So I have to not bring chips in the house if I don't want to eat chips. I'm going to eat all the chips if I have them, but I can, so I can control myself. Like I have a buddy. He's like, I can not buy the chips, but I can't not eat the chips if the chips are here.
Yeah, I'm like that.
So that's an abstainer. Whereas that some people, and I feel like, I don't know if it's across the board, you are one, you know, these are like tendencies, but for me, I feel that way. Like I could tend that way. So I'm like, yeah, why not, you know, risk it? Why not tempt not tempt myself? But for me, like, I mean, TV is a thing that I have in the past, like watched, you know, 6 hours in a row in a night. Or, you know, I remember one time when the show 24 was on, I was like an RA, a resident assistant at Boston University, and I was like on call and had to stay in my room for 24 hours. And I watched like a whole, I watched 15 hours of that show in a row. And
I feel like that's normal now, though. Like, isn't that just sort of how people consume TV now?
Yeah, but I think video games are worse. Even like the sports games, I think Nick Bargatze had some joke that was really funny about how like he was playing this one sports game. And even before you play, you're like the general manager. So even before you start the season, you're setting the price of hot dogs and ticket prices. And he's like, you're paying for 3 hours even before you do anything. So yeah. I feel it's way worse.
That sounds like a good job.
You know, when I got, here's a joke that I tell sometimes, but is really like, this is my true experience. I'm not trying to do a bit on you, but I'm sorry that the regular thought that I had in my standard life experience was funny. Yeah. So sorry. Who am I arguing against? Everyone's fine. You're doing great. Thank you for your graciousness. When I was in the Oculus, in the VR headset world for the first time, and I like looked down at like, you know, I was doing this with my hand. I was like opening and closing my hand, and I was looking at, you know, a virtual hand opening and closing, and I was like, awesome. Isn't that cool? And then like afterwards, I took off the headset and I was like, I took a shower, and then I was like looking down at just my regular hand, and I'm like, that's even better. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so
I thought you were going to be like, what is this shit?
No, I mean, this is way more realistic than, I mean, this simulation is better than that one. That one's a sim in a sim, yeah, if it is one. But yeah, so I feel like similarly, like people can, you're like, oh man, okay, you're the team, so you got to manage the team, and then you got to make sure to pay taxes because you don't want to get in trouble with the electronic IRS, because that's even, they've got their robots that are coming to get you. Like the regular ones in human life, they actually can't really get rich people because they don't have the resources. But in this game, you're pretending to be rich, but you're not really rich, so you're gonna be in trouble. You got to pay your Madden taxes.
Oh, that's I never thought of that. Yeah, it's probably harder to get away from AI.
Well, that's actually, I want to bring that up right now because it's a good segue. So we've been hearing about the chat. Was it GBT?
Yeah.
That AI, I think. And so now this was someone, my friend did this, that you can write a stand-up act from it. It's not that good, but it's not horrible.
And
well, that's scary.
I'm going to read the first joke.
Yeah.
Please,
I'll read the joke. So,
who's going to build the Mexico wall?
Yeah, this is not great, but it's not the worst. It's not funny, but it's like, hey everybody, have you heard of ChatGPT? It's like having a virtual assistant that can do anything, except it won't steal your job yet. Not funny, but this is like the Pong. You know, remember that video game Pong, the first video game? That's what this is.
Yes.
So well, it's a little scary. Here's
I got a couple things for you. I'm gonna go. I have my phone on airplane mode right now because I respect you and your art that we're creating here. But I want to go briefly into my texts, because a couple friends who have gone like really deep into this AI, this chat mm-hmm. world, and one of them here, I'd like to share a brief exchange, yeah. if I may. So my friend Mike Bledger, who is also a comedy writer now, a movie writer, used to do stand-up, doesn't do stand-up as much anymore, super funny guy, very good friend. And so he told me that he asked ChatGPT, can you write me a joke in the style of Mitch Hedberg? Mm. And that's then it wrote... go ahead.
I can't wait to hear this. No, yeah.
Okay, so it said, sure, I can give it a try. Here's a joke in the style of Mitch Hedberg. I used to play sports. Then I realized you can buy trophies. Now I'm good at everything.
Oh my God.
Is that a Mitch Hedberg joke?
Then he wrote back to it, are you aware that the joke you just wrote is a Dimitri Martin joke?
Oh. All right.
And then it said, I apologize for the mistake. The joke I wrote is indeed by Dimitri Martin, not Mitch Hedberg. Thank you for bringing it to my attention. Here's a new attempt. And then they say, I haven't slept for 10 days because that would be too long. And they said, yes, are you aware that that is a Mitch Hedberg joke, not one in the style of it? And he goes back and forth for a little while.
So it already is becoming more human because it's just stealing jokes.
Also,
I think scientists invented Carlos Mencia. I think that's what they did. It wasn't AI.
I mean, Carlos Mencia's name ends with the letter. AI.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah. Mencia AI. Yeah. If I may also, do you guys know the comedian Nick Vatterott?
Yeah, he's great.
Nick is one of my favorites. He's a friend, and he texted me this joke the other day. I don't know if he's doing it in his act or if he tweeted it or whatever, but he just texted me this joke, and I was like, this is the part. He's like, these chat GPT jokes really write themselves.
It's good.
It's beautiful. So Check it out.
I know it's kind of newish, but it is sort of terrifying. Do you ever think of that? I mean, it seems where's it going to be in 10 years? I feel like, you know, a lot of things creatively are just kind of, you know, deteriorating a little bit. And comedy, well, we can get into this, but like stand up, I can't put my finger on exactly what my problem with stand up is now. Probably I'm older. yeah. But just, it's like, I don't know. You know, I have a lot of comedian people following me on Instagram. So whenever I scroll, it's just clips of comedians and they're curating their own things to put out. So they're all killing. So when I watch comedy now, it's just, oh, wow. Everyone's hilarious all the time.
Yeah. So go to an open mic. Yeah. that'll fix that for you.
No, that's true. But, Go ahead.
No, but I do think with stand-up comedy, it's like that'll be the hardest thing for those things to really figure out because it's so personal and creative. You know, like Mike is a very original comedian, so I don't think you'd be worried anytime soon, you know.
No, I think the problem that can arise and already is arising, not in stand-up, but in other artistic sort of frameworks, like in visual art. My understanding is that, you know, the AI can look at, you know, as there's some amount of paintings, you know, some quantity of paintings that it has access to. Like it could look at, you know, Leonardo da Vinci's stuff. It could look at Picasso's stuff. And then when you're like, hey, can you do something in the style of blank? Then it can. It can, you know, make Sarah Silverman look like a Rembrandt, you know, but it's doing that by taking, number one, the art of Rembrandt or whoever it is, and it's taking the art of the photographer who, wherever they got that photo from. So it's already, I feel like, in like treacherous, like legal territory for like who owns the new things. If like they're like, look at this brand new thing we created by mixing together two very specific old things. And like we see with the jokes, it's like, you know, it's either not coming up with great jokes or it's taking great jokes from other people. And, you know, and that is kind of, you know, it is what humans have done at times. You know, you think you write a great joke and you're like, check it out. And they're like, that's a Judy Gold joke. And you're like, okay, you know.
Yeah, Eric does that a lot. He writes a lot of Judy Gold jokes.
I brought her up only because, number one, I love her. And the very first joke I ever had that consistently worked, that like made me feel confident in every, like I was like, this will, I'll tell this, the audience will be on my side for the rest of these 5 minutes, I'll be able to succeed, a week, a month, a couple months later, somebody, an older comedian, you know, in the early 2000s or whenever it was like, that's a Judy Gold joke. And I was like, I don't think I'd known Judy Gold. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen her. Like, I wrote the joke, but she also wrote the joke a decade or two earlier.
Yeah. Have you? Yeah.
Well, you're also seeing this with a lot of young comics that I run into, and they'll do jokes that, and they're so proud of. I don't have the heart to tell them. I'm like, I saw that joke 15 years ago. Someone will tell them at one point, someone on the internet.
Spiro Agnew joke. Yeah, that's been done. Yeah.
Right. I have had that a few times, and it's a bummer because I've written jokes that I'm like, oh, this is a really good joke. And I did just write it. And then actually, it happened with Mitch Hedberg. I had a joke where it was just, it was very something. And I thought it was a really good joke. It was like about, you know, when your apartment gets infested with animals, it's always shitty animals. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, you never come home and you're never like, oh, dude, we got pandas.
Oh, wow. So close as well.
Do you know that his joke, though?
Of course. Yeah.
I don't know that one.
His is like, he koalas. Does it way differently. Yeah. It's like koalas. Yeah. So
cutest
I remember
infestation ever, yeah.
And I remember being like really pissed because I was like, oh, that's a, you know, I did it once and it was like killing. And then I found that out and I was like, oh, so it's going back to what you're talking about with, you know, the legality of, you know, with art and creativity, it's like, that's like the fine line. And like with creativeness or creativity, art is like, because you can't help but, you know, be influenced and take things from different places. But that's kind of the art kind of becomes how you do that. You know what I mean? Like Tarantino, I think, is arguably one of the most original and creative people out there. But what's amazing is he literally is just taking from so many different things that it is new, which is kind of what rap music was and is like they're taking, you know, they are taking from certain different things, but they are creating a new thing. The problem is a lot of people take and they don't make it. That's like what a hack is in comedy. You can see because they're just kind of taking and barely changing a thing. So,
you know, speaking of Nick Vatterott, who I think is also one of the most original, you know, I mean, at a certain point, I feel like there's nobody better than, you know, all of the best, you know, like nobody's better than Maria Bamford. Nobody's better than, you know, whoever your favorite is, like they're at the top of being them. Like nobody's competing with them at what they do because they're doing something, you know, unique and original. Like even if they have a similar topic or a similar joke to someone else, like the totality of their, like, you know, Maria Bamford used to have a similar joke to Mike Birbiglia about both of their greatest fear being bears, you know, and that's like not, it's they're both, like, you know, very original. They're both, you know, doing their own thing and they're kind of nothing like each other, you know, other than they're both uniquely themselves. But so that it can happen, of course. And it's often about the intent, you know, if you're creating something based on your experience with the world, the influences that you have that you can't control what has gone into you other than, you know, you watch art that you like, you take in movies and music and all these other things. And so Nick told me once, I asked Nick Vatterott on my podcast years ago, I was like, Nick, how do you do what you do? Because, you know, sometimes you see somebody like write a joke that's like, if you're a one-liner guy and you write I see the equation there. I see the misdirection. I see you say this and it makes them think that. Then you go this way, you zig and then you zag. And then sometimes you have people who are like, did it just come to you full formed? Like, cause I can't see. And so I asked Nick once, like, how do you do it? How do you be funny? Like, if you can describe it. And he said, well, I'm not claiming to be funny, but if I am funny, here's how I think I'm funny. He's like, I think I just remember everyone that I've ever met. And I think about, you know, maybe not all at once, but I think about if I'm going to do a character, I'll be like, I'll kind of walk like this person from my past. I'll talk in the voice of this lady that I saw at the supermarket the other day. I'll talk about this topic that I overheard these two guys, you know, yelling about on the train. And he's like, I'll conglomerate, you know, take all these stars and create this brand new constellation that is, of course, by the time you get through with it, original. Like if those two guys, if any any of those people saw his comedy, they wouldn't be like, hey, that's 1/7 of me in there. Yeah. It's just because he is the guy who like organically alchemizes it into something brand new. And like you said with Tarantino, like sometimes artists will directly quote and like do homages to, you know, artists from the past. And like, you know, some comedians will do impressions of other, like doing an impression like, hey, that's Jack Nicholson's voice. Like, it'd be weird. Like, that you're not allowed. That Jack Nicholson does his voice. You don't do his voice.
But sometimes there's like movies like that, and everyone will be like, oh, that movie is this other movie. And then they'll go to the director and he'll be like, oh, that was an homage. Like, he'll try to cover his ass. I think he's trying to sneak one by everybody, you know?
Yeah, Fast and the Furious 7 was an homage to the first number 5.
Yeah, James Cameron, isn't Avatar just Pocahontas with blue people? Yeah. And yes, of course. I felt it should be live action and blue. Yeah.
I think they also compared it to that, and Fern Gully, it was another one. They said it was just like, I never even saw either one of those, but
I haven't either.
Well, I was so like, and another thing about Tarantino, and I guess is like why he really gets away with it is because, you know, he's such a total cinephile and, you know, basically maniac about, he just knows everything about pop culture. He's seen everything, just the most obscure, weirdest, bad things. And he like is such a sponge. He just loves it. So what he'll do is he'll see something that's like a movie that like four people have seen that no one has seen, and it's been, you know, made in a basement in Germany, and he'll take something from that and he'll put it in. So he's taking from things that no one really knows and a bunch of those different things. So it is that's kind of in his favor, that just his knowledge is so vast that he can take from so many different things that it hasn't been made, and it's not in the in the consciousness of everyone. And I do think, let me just ask you this though, before, so like, because I've had this happen. So like, have you ever been watching like a serious movie or something, so something that's not comedy, and someone will say something and it's like a funny observation and angle on something, but it's not a comedy and they're not doing it funny, and you've and been like, oh, that could be a joke, and it's not really stealing because it's not comedy. It's just kind of a random observation in like a serious movie. I had that recently. I was with my girlfriend. I saw it. I was like, I feel like that's a funny idea. I wonder if I could do that as a joke. First of all, I don't think anyone would know what it's from. And I'm not.
What's the line? Luke, I am your father. I think people might know.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
It was It was something from Ghostbusters. It wasn't one of the funny parts. No, it was
Who you gonna call?
I don't remember what it was. What?
Who you gonna call? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was so I can't remember what it was, but I remember having that.
I don't think that's stealing. If that guy didn't really come up with the idea, he just had a. He didn't come up with a joke. He just came up with an
observation. And it's not a joke. It's just more like they said something that, like, here's a good example. All right. I was listening to an interview with one of the Central Park Five. Do you know who those guys are? Yeah. So already this is not very funny.
Hilarious. Yeah.
So, you know, people aren't going to be like, you stole that from one of the Central Park Five. so he did a podcast, and in the podcast, he was talking about how hard it was for him to get a job before they were exonerated. And he said, anytime he filled out a job application, he always got to that part where they're like, have you ever been convicted of a violent felony? And then I had to fill it out. And they always wrote, you know, saying yes will not disqualify your chances for the job. And he was like, yeah, all right. But and then I was like, oh, that could be a really funny joke, because everyone has seen that. And it's also like, really? Like, if I put that I, you know, murdered my last boss, like, you're not going to take that into account?
You know, Tom, number one, that is funny. I guess to me, even like, you know, you're of course you're not worried about that non-comedian coming after you for joke theft of his real life struggle. But I honestly think that the way you just told it now, like that's the way that I would do it, to go into the joke, because it's not just the topic. I mean, if that's what you're talking about, then great. Go ahead. Like, say I was listening to this podcast with this guy from the Central Park Five, and like already grounds for comedy, and that but this is a hilarious thing that came out of it. And so then you're even you're citing your source, and you're getting, I feel like, extra laughs out of it. Just, you know, you're not own, because you have new ideas you want to share to it about it as well. Like, you're going to put your own spin on it, but like, why not just share, I listened to this guy say this thing, and I'm like, yeah, that would be, because his particular situation's even, it's more different than just if you're like, I'm looking at this piece of paper.
Yeah.
His situation, I guess, like, he's innocent.
Well, yeah. What was interesting was, it's, you know how like as a comedian, you're always like looking for an angle that not everyone's seeing, but that is like, you know the feeling, like when you notice something that clearly has been staring everyone in the face and no one has noticed it yet, and you're like, oh my god, how did I not come up with that idea for, so that was a good example of like, oh my god, I've seen that on job applications. I've never heard anyone make that comment out loud except for the Central Park Five. So I almost feel like if you want to write jokes, it's almost like watch things not comedy, really. And I watch a lot of different stupid pop culture bad things, and at times I'll be like, oh, that's a really good angle for a joke. I don't steal it for, you know, but it's like they'll spark your brain, you know what I mean?
I've taken a couple of things from people who are not comics, you know, and they'll say something kind of funny and I'll go, oh, that's really good, can I use that? And they're like, Yeah. I mean, like, you know, when you ask a comic, they're like, oh, whoa, everyone tries to take possession. But if you talk to like a civilian, they're like, yeah, I don't care. They're almost happy that you're using it.
Yeah. They're like flattered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's a couple things. Number one, eventually, Tom, don't let me forget to tell you something nice about you. That's going to be the fourth thing that I say. Okay?
All right. Well, let's just get into that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I don't do this as a, I do this as a joke on podcasts, like right now. But you know, I have more ideas.
You
than
are
I
very
get
forthcoming
to...
about your intentions.
I like everyone to have all the information. But you know, I have a joke about the very situation that you just mentioned, Eric, where like, so my girlfriend is not a comedian, but she is funny and says funny things and actually, you know, contributes to my comedy actively, as well as, you know, every once in a while she'll just say something like, oh, that would be, and we agree. We're like, yeah, with her permission, because she's not a comedian separate from me, I'll use that. Or if my mom says something funny, either on purpose or not, I'll always be like, mom, I'm gonna say that unless it would make you feel that. Or like, you know, parents with their kids, a kid says a weird thing. Anyway, of course, out in the world. Yeah. But it's funny, like if a friend of mine who's a comedian says something that's funny, I'm like, you should do that in your act. You should do that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It, like, do you do that? You don't do that? You should do that.
They'll say, I don't want to do it, would you be like,
oh, I would happily take it if they don't want to do it. But for a comedian, I'm like, you should do that. Sometimes when a non-comedian friend says something funny, I have the inclination to be like, you should say that. And they're like, yeah, I just said it. Like, that's like the purest form of comedy, you know?
You should open with that in all of your interactions.
Yeah, I think it'll work on everyone, not just me right now, even though it's about me. Like, Albert Brooks was once interviewed by, I think, Judd Apatow in that book, Sick in the Head, great bunch of interviews. And I think it's in there that Albert Brooks said, like, sometimes he would go to the Tonight Show to do the Tonight Show, to be a guest, and he's going to do panel. And he's on the way over there deciding what he's going to do. And like, he'll talk to someone on the phone and they'll be like, what are you going to do? And then he tells them the funny story that he's planning to tell on the Tonight Show. And then after he finishes the story to the friend on the phone, he's like, well, now I can't do that. I just did it. And then he has to do something else in his own mind. He's like, that it's the same thing to him, whether he's telling a good friend a 5-minute story or telling it to, you know, Johnny Carson or Leno or
right,
what have
right.
you. But the thing that you were saying about some like Tarantino finding like very obscure things because he has such a wide range of knowledge on movies. Like, I feel like the other way is a different route as well. When you take things that are so clearly so blatant, like if a jazz singer quotes Happy Birthday, nobody's like, hey, that's a different song. You know, they're like, they get what you're doing in their solo. And they're like, oh, that didn't fit with there. That's a cool new thing. Or there's a comedian friend of mine, Ramin Nazer. He's fantastic. I love him.
Yeah, I know. Okay, yeah.
So Ramin, he has one stand-up album that he made like 10 years ago, and I think it's so funny. And there's just one part of it where he's doing it in front of an audience like that, you know, he's not a world renowned famous comedian that everyone knows, and he's doing it in front of not necessarily all comedy fans, but he tells a joke, and then at one point after a joke he says, I don't care who you are, that's funny right there, in Larry the Cable Guy's voice, because that's the thing that Larry the Cable Guy says, and he's quoting Larry the Cable Guy to people who might recognize, but most likely probably, but I'm like, I thought it was like the funniest thing, because, and it's not like Larry the Cable Guy is like just for, you know, making a German movie in a basement. He's performing.
Do the people laugh at that? How does it go over?
I think it gets a laugh, but I'm not sure if it's that some people are laughing just because it's a funny thing for him to say in a weird voice at that moment. Which is kind of like the way a lot of people enjoy, like, you know, as a kid, you watch the Muppets and they're like socks talking. You're like, hooray, the sock is dancing, you know. And as an adult, you're like, these socks were playing. They were playing some pretty elaborate games and sent some pretty impressive like social commentary there, these socks. But and that's a beautiful thing when everyone can enjoy that. Third thing. We're almost to you, Tom. there's an author named Arthur Brooks, as opposed to Albert Brooks. Arthur C. Brooks, I believe, was a professor at Harvard who studies happiness. And I read a book that he wrote. and that'd be a fun way for him to say it. I wrote a book that Mike Kaplan read. It's called From Strength to Strength. And it's about how when you're younger, there's two different kinds of intelligence, he says. One is like crystallized and one is fluid. And he said, when you're younger, you're better at fluid intelligence. Like you can do so many more different things. That's why like people who Nobel Prize winners, most of their work that they got awarded for in the earlier part of their career. And like an athlete, you know, everyone has like an arc that they'll reach their peak potential. And then, you know, slowly they'll gradually descend. And that curve, he said, you can leap from that curve to the second curve, which is maybe doesn't ever have to decline as much, where like in the latter part of his life, Bach, you know, in the beginning of his life, he's the most famous composer. Then people stopped really enjoying like his kind of music, got out of favor. His son made all different kinds of music, became much more successful and popular than him in his lifetime, but Bach became a teacher. And that's why we have all of, you know, his work today. And so the crystallized kind of intelligence like encapsulates, like you're able to like zoom out and step back, and you're not necessarily innovating in the same way that you were when you were younger, but you are able to like sort of cohere everything together. And so I feel like that's what, you know, Quentin Tarantino might be, maybe he was innovating more in his younger days. Maybe now he's just like, because of all of the knowledge that he has, he's like, oh yeah, I can see that if I put this with this, with this, with this, then it does seem like a brand new thing. Because also that's maybe the only way that brand new things, like, cause there, you know, no matter can ever be, or energy can be created or destroyed. It's all shifting around and being reframed. But anyway,
Who wrote that book though? Arthur Brooks.
Yeah.
And Albert Brooks. Okay. Also, by the way, you probably know this little trivia. What's Albert Brooks's real name?
Einstein.
Yeah.
Albert Einstein.
His brother is Bob Einstein.
Is that Super Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But imagine that's a tough name to grow up with Albert Einstein. You got really like high expectations there. I mean, he probably exceeded them, but
yeah, those two Albert Einsteins did a pretty good job, both of them. So Tom.
Okay, here we go. Now to the main
of my set.
Now I'll start listening again.
Tom's
last name was originally Einstein. Tom Einstein, right?
Nobody.
Earlier when you were bemoaning that Mitch Hedberg had written a joke that you also had separately written and he achieved success with it widely and publicly either before you did or, you know, such a way that you were like, I guess I can't also continue doing my joke because his is too similar and is out there. When that has happened to me, in ways as well. And I encourage you, if you can, maybe this is more me than you, but I feel like the generous reading of it is like, you came up with an idea that has entertained millions. Like, you came up with, like, your brain did just as good a job as, like, one of the most beloved comedians of all time. Like, you're on the right track. Like, it's not like that joke was the only joke you've ever written and you're like, oh no, Mitch Hedberg took it. Like,
it's kind of like when you find out a girl you're dating banged like some really big, like Brad Pitt or something.
Yeah.
I suppose it could be like that. Yeah, you could tell that. Tell your joke and Hedberg's joke and talk about Brad Pitt.
I think a lot of it comes from writing a lot, though. If you write like a lot and Tom writes a lot, it's just going to happen. It's going to happen. You write a lot of jokes.
Oh, yeah, But wait, were you going to say something more about that? I'm sorry. I thought you were going to give me a suggestion of how to like change it or something, but no.
No. You can't change the joke. Just change your attitude and personality and be grateful that you've come up with such a wealth of experience. That was my suggestion. But sincerely, kind of continuing and with what Eric was just saying, there's a thing I learned about once called rapid prototyping. Which is, let's say they took a class, a ceramics class, and they split it in half, and they said, one class, spend the whole time making one perfect pot. Try to spend like the entire time perfecting one pot. And the other class, the other half, they said, just spend the whole time making as many pots as you can. And at the end of the time, the side of the class that was making multiple pots were able to and were consistently making pots that were better than the one pot that they spent their best time on, which is, you know, I feel like in comedy as well, like the more jokes you write, the better you get at writing jokes, like the less precious we have to be about any one particular joke. Of course, you come up with a joke, you love your joke, you're like, what a great joke. You find out somebody else has the joke. In the beginning, that was all when I found out that Judy Gold had written my joke years earlier, I was like, oh no, what am I going to do now? Like, because at that point, we're coming from a place of lack and uncertainty.
And I was never one of those. You know how people would get very like angry about someone else having a joke like theirs? Like, they'd be like, oh man, I have a joke like that. They stole it. Like, my attitude was always, even if I did, if someone, it seemed like, did something. I remember there were a few times people were like, you know, someone's doing a joke exactly like yours. And I was like, all right, well, I mean, I'll just write more jokes. I mean, my attitude was always like, what am I going to do? That's kind of like a compliment. And I'm sure it's just.
Yeah. A comic friend of mine, he does this thing sometimes where he'll see a young comic and they'll have a great joke and it crushes. And then when they get off stage, he goes, you know, Bill Burr has the same joke. And he's totally fucked. You see them go white. They go fucking white. It's such a mean thing, but it's also really
that is
funny.
Mean. That's like it would happen early on where people would be like, that thing where you'd have a joke about dating, and someone would be like, you know, early, you know, young comedians would be like, oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I talk about that too. You know, you're just like, right. I think it's kind of open territory. So
yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah,
because some people
thing.
Are like, when I first started, I did joke about the subway, and someone's like, oh, I have a joke about the subway. I'm like, so you own the subway? I don't understand.
Actually, who owns dating is Craig Shoemaker, the love master, I believe, the love whatever. I forget what it's called, but. That's so funny. Here's a note. I don't know who your friend is, Eric, who does this hilarious make people feel bad Bill Burr bit. Actually, Bill Burr does that to people, so you should tell him to stop. And
he's feeling bad for Bill Burr.
Here's my note. And maybe he does this. Maybe I'll be generous. Maybe this is exactly what he does. My favorite, like, is I don't love pranks. I like a prank if it's like half a second long. You'd be like, oh my God, oh, everything's fine now. And just kidding. I don't even like them like that. But if they're going to happen, I like them to be over almost before you're done. You know, I don't want to make people feel bad or get scared. Like, I want to have fun. And so here's the way that I would do it. If I were going to do that, which I wouldn't, is have it be like, hopefully a joke that like Bill Burr would never do. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like a non-binary comedian comes off stage. Not that I'd want to, you know, make a marginalized person feel worse, but you know, like the most, like, let's say, you know, a white guy, a straight white guy telling like the most progressive joke about, you know, the intersectionality of gender, race, orientation, identity, and be like, yeah, man, that's Bill's new thing. Like, at least then that that would be like a bonus. Be yeah. like, what?
Yeah,
that would make me feel
Dice Clay does the same
Burr.
Joke.
Exactly. I love it.
I did a show once. It was me and Kurt Metzger were doing a college. And this is hilarious. He was opening for me. That's a really hilarious part. But they came to like pick us up, like four people in a van. Like, I guess they were really into the show. It was like a small college. And it was like a 2 or 3 hour drive. And about an hour into the drive, the guy who was the organizer or whatever, I don't know, was like, yeah, you know, by the way, just the school is like really religious and you can't curse and you can't do any kind of blue material. And I was headlining. And I mean, I definitely had, you know, jokes where I talked about sex and, you know, not like it was like filthy, but I mean, and so, and Kurt was like, really? Oh man, that sucks. Oh God. So like, this went on for like about an hour and a half where I'm going through my entire set and like rewriting my set. And then finally one of them leans to me and whispers like kind of to not like ruin it for him. Like, you know, like he's kidding, right? That's not true. And I was just like, and you know, I played off like, oh yeah, no, I like, yeah, of course he's kidding. But it was, I remember being like, what, why would you do that? Like it's already like, I love when people try and throw obstacles at comedians. It's like, yeah. It's already like impossible. Like, just let me fucking make it as easy as possible. Like,
yeah, the worst thing is like, you'll do a show and they'll actually, this will be true, but someone will go up to you right before you go on stage. There's a really important person in the crowd right now. And they tell you right before you go on, I'm like, why would you do this to me? Like, why?
By the way, your parents who have never met you are in the crowd tonight. Yeah. And they said, this is your one shot to get their love.
Yeah. Cool. I love it. If I may, here's how I would do it. There's somebody really important in the room tonight. And afterwards you tell them, it was you. You're the important one.
That's like some cult leader shit.
Yeah, I mean, and Tom, the situation that you were in, like when you really started, you know, second guessing everything that you were able to do, like as a joke, like the joke was done and they could have been like, when you were like, oh no, then they'd be like, just kidding. Like right there. Like yeah. That's a perfect time for a 1.5 second prank.
Right. Like, it was like, and it was basically one guy was kind of like letting the genie out of the box. You know what I mean? Like he was kind of like, I'm going to tell you because they don't want to like ruin the joke. And it's like, so you were just the entire ride. Let me up until the show started. Like, it's just basically like, hey, we want to make sure like the show is bad as possible.
Do you have any like rituals before your show? Like, do you like to really freak out a lot about how it's going to go? Is that like your main, do you have a thing that you like to eat in the green room while you question your entire life up until this point? Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I guess it's that thing where, you know, when they're around comedians, they feel like they have to like hang with the comedian and they think that that is kind of like giving the business or like, you know, and they think comedians, for some reason, people have this idea that comedians are really strong, not sensitive people. Yeah. Like, you know, they're always like the hecklers, like, hey, come on, man, just you're a comedian. It's like, just because I'm a comedian doesn't mean I don't hate when people yell insults at me. Like, it does make me feel bad. You know what I mean? Like, that's one thing I had later in comedy where people would scream at me and I wouldn't, or, you know, when people would heckle or something. And I kind of would come out of it sometimes and be like, look, I know, I don't know what you're doing, but like, I am a person here and I am like talking and it's already hard. So like, can you just like, let me do the thing? Like people yelling at you while you're trying to do a thing it's just going to make it worse for you. So does that make any, you know what I mean? Like comedians, I think are the most sensitive people in the world. So it's a weird thing that people look at us as like these hardened individuals, which I guess you kind of have to become in a sense.
Yeah, well, that's what hecklers think a lot. They go, oh, you could take it. You're a professional. I'm like, you can't take someone yelling over every joke. That's not – no comedy.
Yeah, what do you mean take it? I can take not them not hearing me?
You know, it's like imagine if like the world's greatest, you know, Olympic class archer is getting ready to line up their shot to get a bullseye in the Olympics, and then right before they shoot, right as they're shooting, somebody in the crowd shoots them with an arrow and they're like, hey, if you can dish it out, why can't you take it, you know? that's the way that some people conceive of comedy and comedians. Like, but here's the thing, I did a house show over the weekend in Boston. It was super fun. It was great. And afterwards, they had, you know, there's people sort of continued to gather, and it was a little party. And there was a young woman there, I think possibly like a college student or maybe even like a young lady who was like, people are always telling me that I should do, I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter and I like perform. And she's like, sometimes I talk to the audience in between the songs, and like, so always people laugh and like, that's fun. And so people have been like, well, you should do stand up. And she's like, but I'm worried because like, I'm super shy off stage. Like I don't have the kind of personality that I'm like, oh yeah.
Sounds you
don't
like you're have a comedian.
To. Yeah. You can just do the comedy you could just perform on stage. But even in that, like, she could be a comedian. She is a performer. She does funny things, but she still has like, you know, the misconception that so many do, as you're saying, that people think that, I mean, some comedians are on more of the time than other comedians, but of course there's many comedians that are like yabba dabba doo then off stage like gonna go home, you know, or sit quietly.
I was very disappointed when I met Fred Flintstone in person.
Hey man, I thought you're always just splitting a bowling ball in half. Have a good time.
Well, the worst thing is, I don't know if this is this was a show at a restaurant, listen, one nighters, and sometimes the owner of the restaurant wants to start the show themselves, which is always a bad thing. And I was hosting. And he's like, I'll bring you up. I'm like, you know what? I'll just go up. He's like, no, I'll bring you up. So he goes up for like a minute and a half and he's shitting on me, you know? And I'm like, this is your business. This is like all these. I'm like, I'm fucked. And the show's going to probably suck because I'm going to bomb. And what are you doing?
He's saying like, this guy's bad or something.
Yeah. He goes, this guy, I never heard him before. He's an amateur. I'm like, what the?
But I think they think you're supposed to roast comedians. It's like, I think they're like, I remember Mark Norman when he first was kind of around, he would always say these obnoxious insults to me. I didn't know. He was like this guy out of nowhere. And then later on, I was like, he was like, I remember I did that. And I'm like, well, why would you do that all the time? And he's like, oh, you know, I thought that's what you were supposed to do. Like, you couldn't be obsequious. You had to kind of like, you know, give him a hard time and act like you didn't really give a shit. And I was like, but I would just be standing there and you would just say weird things. Like, you think the girl I'm dating is fucking other people. Like, that's not roasting. That's like ruining my fucking year. So, I guess that's just what it, and I am someone who, like, I'm really polite and nice, but when people are rude to me and say mean things to me, I get really upset about it and I get defensive. And I think I got, you know, I wouldn't react the way that people wanted me to react, but I guess I just didn't understand that. It took me a while to understand that that's why people were doing it. I just assumed.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's an immature understanding of stand up from either within it. Like, you know, when I was younger, I had the idea that like, yeah, you gotta have a thick skin and you gotta make other people everybody's gotta have thick skins and nobody should ever connect because you're thin. Your skin is too thick, you know? But then you find out eventually like, oh yeah, if you just, you know, you don't have to do that. Like, people have a misconception.
I'm not a dinosaur.
Yeah. Like, do you know that the idea of an alpha male, like in our society, is like, it's a misunderstanding of like the scientific phenomenon of like the alpha in a wolf pack or the alpha in a pack of primates. You know, the alpha isn't the one who's just like can beat everybody up and is like the macho boss. It's somebody who like fosters connection and communication, and like, you know, they help if outsiders come in. They don't necessarily stop everyone on their own, but they're liked, they're likable, they're like kind of like a good president, you know.
So
they're
more what the alpha is, as opposed to what the conception is that
exactly.
It's somebody's just like, fuck you to everyone, get away from me, I'm gonna beat the shit out of you.
Exactly.
I always thought that too, because like, there seems to be some weird renaissance happening now, where not renaissance, but like something in the culture where people are just kind of there's all these male comedians who are getting a lot of hot women, like on a large scale in you know, celebrities, and it seems to be this thing that people are just acting like is a brand new concept of like, you know, it turns out like, you know, women, like, they kind of like these like charismatic, like funny guys who are just like fun to be around. And like, they kind of say clever things. Like, what's going on with the world? And it's like, yeah, no, I feel like that's kind of like why a lot of people did. I just always feel like, I mean, I don't know what it was when you were younger, but I felt like I discovered young, like, oh, I have, like, I'm funny, and that helps me get attention from people, and it's positive attention. So, but have you, do you know what I'm talking about? Like, there's kind of a thing going, like the whole Pete Davidson phenomenon, which is like incredible to me, because like, I, first of all, I get it. You know what I mean? Pete Davidson, he's a rich and famous funny guy. And like, but.
And he's also a nice guy. And I think that's the part that a lot of people, because there's a lot of rich and famous comedians who aren't in the same position that he's in. But like, you know.
He comes off nice too. He's likable.
Yeah. I mean, like, well, he had a tragic, you know, experience, early, a traumatic experience, a loss in his family that. You know, it's not that losing a parent young always makes you into a kind-hearted, sensitive person, but it very much can do that. I just watched a one-man show, a super hilarious, wonderful show called Sugar Daddy. It's this guy, he's 28. He's a comedian named Sam Morrison. I've known him for a few years.
Since I know him.
Yeah, since a little before the pandemic. And he... In the past, you know, he dated a man who's like in his 50s, and that man died, you know, 3 years into their relationship, I believe, of COVID.
Oh, wow.
And so he has now this show. And then Sam, the now living, continuing living comedian who lost his partner, has experienced this tremendous grief and has learned so much from the experience. He also developed diabetes, like, because of the grief, like the that's what the doctors have said. And so he has now this one-man show that's all about the love that they shared, the grief that he experienced, the physical and emotional and effects. And it's so goddamn funny. It's so, like, it's so hilarious. And he specifically, I see, like, he's a 28-year-old and he is wiser than most people, you know, twice his age, because he has now, he's in grief counseling groups with people three times his age, you know, just a bunch of, like, you know, people who've lost their spouses after 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And so, like, that kind of loss can, like, you know, it can harden a person, but it can also really soften a person, like, you know, make somebody understand, you know, kind of, I don't mean to spoil anything, but one of the messages of the show is that love is the only thing that's important. Love is the most important thing in the world. Sorry, you don't have to see the show now, but I do recommend it. It's called
First
Sugar
of all,
Daddy.
I disagree completely.
Very funny counterpoint. That's fair. I'll entertain that.
No.
You may be right. So with Pete Davidson, I feel like I don't know him super well. Like, you know, I know him very little bit here and there. But my, you know, from the people that I know him and from what I've seen and heard, like, it's not only like physical things. It's not only monetary things. It's not only fame things that are drawing people to him. Like, once you're, you know, once you're Kim Kardashian, once you're at a level of fame where, like, you could, if you want, meet whoever you want and pretty much talk to whoever you want, then that kind of, you know, the veil can, you know, be lifted and you're like, well, who do you want to talk to and for what reason? Like, it's not just that he's a funny guy. It's that he's a genuine, cool, nice dude.
Well, he's someone that I've, I just think it's funny because, you know, that has been kind of a running joke for a little bit about, because now he's the punchline of, and then she fucked Pete. And it's so amazing to me because I remember, you know, when Pete Davidson was just this kid around doing stand up, and it's amazing to me watching him become like the fucking Warren Beatty of our generation, you know, just kind of the like unadulterated, like, go-to guy. And it's, one thing I will say about him is, like, when he was on SNL and stuff, he was someone immediately I was like, oh, I get that. He's someone that, like, has, you know, when they're always talking about, like, the it factor and, like, you just can't put your finger on what he has, like, a thing. Like, when you, he just has, like, a presence, you know, and I'm very, like, I feel like I'm good at, you know, seeing someone who has, like, a very good presence in pop culture. I'm obsessed with pop culture too. So, like, I'm less of, you know, some people are like, I love that actor and they're the great and they're so talented at this. I'm more fascinated by people who, like, maybe don't even seem like that talented. Not that they're not talented, but their talent is more like just them, something from them. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's some people who are famous who are like, they're not the greatest actors. They're not even the best at what they're doing. Like, I don't think Pete Davidson's like the best comedian. I mean, he's good, but he does have a thing that a lot of comedians don't have. He just has. Do you know, is this like making any sense? He has that star thing. I don't know. You can't really say it.
Yeah, he's got big thing energy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
maybe that's what's steeping in.
I remember seeing when he was like 16 and like, I was less like, I'm like, who is this kid? And like, cause he sounds like he was 40. He was 16, but he sounded like a 40-year-old construction worker from Staten Island. And like, oh, he's 16. I'm like, that's, I mean, he looks 16, but he doesn't sound 16. So that's always the thing that I thought really kind of made him.
Yeah. Different. And he was getting, you know, but I definitely wasn't like, oh, this guy's going to be dating Kim Kardashian in 5 years. And like, that's going to be a normal thing. And probably breaking up with her. That's the most hilarious part. He's like, so anyway, enough about Pete Davidson.
But, yeah.
All right. Glad to be here on the Pete Davidson Hour. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
They probably could do that. All right. Well, we have to wrap this up, but you should come on again because there's actually like I had all these things I was going to ask you.
Well, ask him one more question. You have time for one more question?
I'll happily return, but also I'll happily answer.
There was just a lot. I was going to ask you. So, like, you know, your comedy is, you know, obvious. You know, it's very intellectual, and you're very into like wordplay. And did you, you know, you started out in Boston, right?
I did.
So, what was that a struggle at all for like certain kind? What was it like starting to do comedy there when you were kind of maybe a more, not that everyone there's like an idiot, but you know what I mean? Like there'd be certain rooms that maybe like
meatheads.
I mean, I feel like I've done rooms on the road and stuff where like, and I'm not really, you know, not that I think I'm smart and I have smart jokes, but I'll do jokes and I'm like, oh, this is just too much for the crowd because I'm talking about like reading. So what have you experienced that a lot or what?
Yeah. You just figure out, be like, you know, reading like a menu, you know, you have to look at a menu sometimes, you know, like when you have to figure out which flight you're getting on.
Well, you just strike me as someone that like what is your IQ? Do you have a really high IQ? I know it's like a weird question.
I don't know. I did well in school, if that helps you. But I'll say this, that two things. First, Boston, I mean, is not a monolith. In fact, and it's not just a binary either, but like I started at the Comedy Studio in Harvard Square, where like at the time, like Brendan Small and the Walsh Brothers and Eugene Merman was like they were like that the guys there at the time who were like, you know, really getting a lot of spots and rising and like, you know, people were paying attention to and eventually, you know, got to start making TV and being on Conan and like Conan, you know, Brian Kiley was a Conan writer who was also had started out there and like Conan's like producers would come every year for a certain time and like do auditions and they would be like, oh yeah, these are like because Boston was a great, you know, had a history of great joke writing. And obviously like, you know, Dane Cook's from Boston, Bill Burr's from Boston, and they're not like one-liner guys, but you know, Stephen Wright and Wendy Liebman.
Yeah, that's true. And even like Eugene Merman, especially when he was kind of, you know, New York coming up, he was, you know, kind of the early parts of the alt scene. And, you know, not that he was like super intellectual, but his comedy was different. And
yeah, but really some of the greatest comics have come out of Boston. It is like really...
It's fantastic. Look at the list, thank you so much. That's very kind of you to say.
You're included. You're included in the list.
What I'm saying, I included myself already. You don't even need to say. But so there was, I remember talking to Brian Kiley once about how, like, because you're right that there is also, there's the Comedy Studio, which was right across the street from Harvard, and then, you know, right near MIT, and there's like a ton of students in Boston. So there was an audience for intellectual, like, comedy nerds. And then also, it was a great place to start because, you know, across the river, like downtown, you know, Faneuil Hall, Boston, there was the Comedy Connection. And Brian Kiley told me, he's like, whenever I have a joke that does well at the Comedy Studio, and the Comedy Connection, I'm like, I know that's a good joke because like at the Comedy Connection, it could be just like, People who don't even speak English who came in from a hostel that Tuesday night, or it could be people who are just, you know, the equivalent of being barked in, like, or it's a tourist area, it's just tourists, or it's, you know, like the people that, you know, the extras from Good Will Hunting, you know, South Boston. There, there is, like, you know, a bunch of, you know, a range of diverse classes and races, and, you know, it's not that they're all, like, everywhere, but you could definitely perform in many in front of many different kinds of audiences, and I definitely didn't do well in front of almost any audience in the beginning. But
when did you start in Boston?
Like 2002-ish, okay. I would say. I did perform musical comedy for the first time in late 1999 at the Comedy Studio. I was pursuing music in my senior year of college. Maybe it was 2000. It was 99, 2000 was my senior year of college. And so I was mainly pursuing music, and I had some funny songs. And so I played them at the Comedy Studio. And then, but I only got on there, and I was mostly performing at music open mics and stuff. But I would get up at the Comedy Studio like a couple times a year. He would just have me on, and I'd bring some friends and be fun. But 2002 is when I started really writing jokes, pursuing comedy, going to open mics, and, you know, failing a ton, you know, by the metrics of like people laughing at most of the things that I said, which they did not do. But I found like both, I never thought about it like this. I always thought like the way that I am and like a lot of the things that I'm interested in, like, you know, I would talk about being a vegan. I would talk about like not wanting kids. I would talk about eventually like, you know, at one point being an atheist, at another point being like, you know, sort of spiritually psychedelic or psychedelically spiritual. Like at one point I would talk about like open relationships. I was doing all these things that at the time were like, you know, non-normative, you know, that most people wanted kids, wanted, you know, believed in whatever, believed everything different. And so for me, I felt like I had to individually like make all the jokes that much better to even like, I would start out, you know, a joke about being vegan. Like, I'm vegan. Are there any other douchebags here? And people would be like, okay, good. He knows. Yeah, he knows. That's what we think of him. Absolutely. 100%. And so I feel like, and it wasn't just as simple as like, there's a trick that I could do every time. I just, if I really wanted to express what I believed in and people didn't believe the same thing, then, which is fine. It's good that not everybody believes the exact same thing, but to, you know, have people be open enough to receive the joke and the ideas that I was talking about,
right.
I had to craft it that all that more meticulously. And so I feel like that was happening on a personal level. And then on a larger, like, you know, societal level, like, I was like, oh, yeah, I could do some of my jokes and not even have to change anything, not have to figure anything out, just be like, whatever, in front of this audience of like students at Brown University or whatever, and then tell those same jokes. I'm like, I have an hour of comedy that I could do at this university, and then take that hour to, you know, the Comedy Connection in Faneuil Hall and be like, that hour is 3 minutes long. And okay, well, now let's work on the next 3 minutes. Well,
you just got to add a bunch of go socks, and that'll get you to the 10 minutes. I mean, but that's a real question, because I always think there's all really funny comics come out of, you're from that area, Boston area?
I grew up in New Jersey. I just went up there for school.
Oh, okay. What makes that area? I mean, but you lived there for a while. Like, why are people funny? I always try to put my finger on it. I don't know why. It just seems like there's a lot of great.
Yeah.
Something about the area, though.
Something in the.
There's something about it. I'll give you the answer that I once heard the Dalai Lama give this answer to a question that he was asked. He said, "That is a very good question, and the answer is simple. I don't know." So, I mean, truly, I think it could be the fact that there are so many, like, it's a small area, but like with a lot of different sub communities of, you know, like different kinds of people that, you know, you like New York as well, you know, like you have everything all around you in a very smushed together, limited area. And so you get to potentially, if your eyes are open to it, you learn a lot from the world around you by observing and listening to people in situations who are near you, but not the exact same as you. And the fact that there's, you know, so many schools up there, like so many people, like it's a city, I think 1/4 of the population of the city at a given time, I heard, is students, that it's just like, you know, a million people and a quarter million of them are students. And so it's just like continual growth and learning and education and just, you know, people being open to, you know, finding out what's going on in life and the universe and communicating that. So
that's interesting.
Something in the water, maybe. I don't know.
And smart schools. Short those, answer. Those are kids that go to good schools, so they're not dummies. So it's good to perform in front of crowds like that.
Yeah, love that dirty water. Yeah, that. Yeah, that one. Yeah.
And then just another thing I was gonna. So you moved to New York in 2008, right? Is that
that's right
around that time?
100%.
And then what was your? So what was the first thing you did? You like your first big thing? Like maybe you thought it was like a break. Was did it happen here? Did you move here and then like? Was it like the Comedy Central thing?
It was. In 2007, before I moved from Boston, they did, you know, used to be the Laugh Riots, the competition.
Yeah.
That in 2007, when I did it, it was called the Open Mic Fights.
Right.
And so there was like, I think, 8 of us in Boston, and there were like 9 cities where they each did it. And I think I came in second. And actually, the guy who came in first was a guy named Pat Bacuzzi, who doesn't do comedy anymore. And I hadn't seen him in 15 years until 2 days ago, or three
really?
Days ago, when he was officiating the wedding of a mutual friend in Boston. And we were just, hey, this guy, what have you been up to for 15 years? But he was super funny. He won, and I came in second. But then in that competition, everyone who came in second in all the 9 cities, there were 3 wild card spots, and I got the wild card spot, and beating out Mike Vecchione, and whoever heard from him after that.
Did you have to go after that to the LA finals?
I did. I went out to the LA finals. I did. I didn't win. I didn't place. But I think of the 12 of us that were out there, I think. If not all of us, I think maybe all of us, but most of us got to be on Comedy Central's Live at Gotham the following season.
Right.
So I think I got that call in like late 2007. I recorded it in like March of, and then it came out in June of 2008. And then I did move to New York. I mean, coincidentally, I was planning to move at some point, but I moved in that summer of 2008 to New York, having that fresh first TV credit that I get to New York and I'm like, I was on this. And then they're like, yeah, there's been so many seasons of Live at Gotham and Premium Blend that they're like, yeah, that and an audition will, how do I get an audition? Like, you don't. Like, you know, it would be years before I was passed at, you know, the comic strip, the Cellar, whatever it might be. But then I did do a few competitions that first year that I was in New York that went pretty well. And I did start working at Caroline's pretty regularly, and I don't work there anymore.
Yeah.
And look what happened.
I just got passed there.
Yeah, I got 7 spots there next month. That and Dangerfield.
It's a little harder to get into the physically into the
No,
place,
you know what they're going to be now, right? You know what they're turning into, right?
No, I don't.
Like this a big ping pong place.
Wow, man. Yeah. You know that there's this old story of a Chinese farmer that he had a horse that ran away, and they were like, bad news, right, guy? And he's like, maybe yes, maybe no. And then the next day the horse comes back and brings other horses with it, like wild horses. And they're like, wow, you've got a bunch of horses now. That's great news. He's like, maybe yes, maybe no. Then his son the next day is trying to tame one of the horses, gets thrown and breaks his leg. They're like, oh, broken leg on your son. Bad news. He's like, maybe yes, maybe no. Next day, the army comes to town, drafts every able-bodied male. And they're like, oh, your son didn't have to get drafted. Great news. He's like, maybe yes, maybe no. And I was like, oh, man, I thought the Caroline's closing was bad news. Like, maybe yes, maybe no. Ping pong, my dream, my calling.
There
I'm there.
In that story, that was a really big week for that guy.
Oh,
a lot of stuff happened. The horses, and then the horses came back, and then the
exactly.
Yeah, I love that parable. Yeah, the sometimes it's described as him saying, "Yeah, maybe or so." But yeah, that's the whole. What is it like? I forgot what it is. Like, you know, wait a while. That I'm not saying it right, but you know the whole thing. What is it? The official
Heinz ketchup. Good things come to those who wait. You leave your
well.
Ketchup,
it's kind of like if things aren't going the way you want, just like wait, because it's just sort. You know, I think people get caught up in, you know, especially now. That's like, you know, I think the main problem in our culture now is everyone immediately wants a remedy for everything. Like, I don't feel good. I want this right now. But the whole parable of just,
you know,
like,
you know, what's really funny about that ping pong place is usually these bars or some of these places, when they, if they don't start doing well, you know what they bring in? Stand-up comedy. So wouldn't it be funny if they do a comedy show?
I think, like, that's definitely on the horizon.
So that's
you
great.
Know that's gonna and happen.
Eric, if I may, you should say that.
All right. Well, we brought it full circle. We'll end on that. Thanks a lot.
Oh, of course.
I want to thank Mike Kaplan for coming on.
Go ahead.
And thank you.
Yeah, you got thank anything you. To plug? Anything yeah. to plug?
Check out his podcast. Oh. I know Broccoli and Ice Cream. And go
yeah,
ahead.
Dude, check out my episode with Tom and there are other ones as well. I've got another podcast called The Faucet, which is just like, it's just like this, except with only me and not you. And I pretty much, Mike Kaplan, spelled the weird way I spell it, everywhere at MYQKAPLAN, my website, all the social media. And you mentioned at the top of the show, my latest album is called AKA, and I'm, you know, touring as much as possible. Hopefully later this year, I don't know exactly when, I should have a new dry bar comedy special coming out that I recorded a little over a year ago.
Oh, you already recorded it?
Oh, cool. Yeah. Recorded it in late 2021. And
did you do another one before that? You said it was your...
This is my number one premiere debut.
It gets a lot of views. Those things get a lot of views. Those are pretty good.
That's what they say. I mean, that's what I see.
And you can't curse and you can't say anything really dirty.
That's correct. There are very strict parameters for... So I went back, you know, to prepare for it through my... I had, I think at that point, 5 albums of comedy that I had released, you know, that was about 5 hours worth. My girlfriend and I were on a road trip. We listened to all of my albums and took notes. And I think we came up with about 1 hour of jokes that could be said under those parameters. And then they only needed a half hour. So I can do another one.
I knew a comic who did it and he was shocked at like what they said crossed the line. One of the things was he was making fun of his wife and they're like, you can't do that. That's crossing the line.
Really?
Nothing sexual. It's just, you know, but you know, it's fun to
apply. They were like, hey, no talking. That really makes everyone uncomfortable. That's what it's going to be like in 5 years. Comedy. Hey, no talking. Don't say
things. Yeah. You check out my new mime bar special. Yeah.
People are really... Yeah, I have a lot of no-liners. One-liners, sorry.
Tom, that's good. I like it.
I should say that. Okay. All right. Well, Mike Kaplan, check out his podcast, check out his albums and his special and all that stuff. And
thank you.
Thanks for coming on, and we'll talk to you later. Thanks for tuning in.
Appreciated. Same to you.